Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
Bird flu and the next pandemic. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Bird flu is turning up all over the world, in birds. So far, the only humans affected are those in immediate contact with birds, but the virus is deadly. There's concern it will mutate so it can pass from human to human. That could lead to an outbreak worldwide. On To The Point, researchers simply don't know if bird flu will do that or just disappear. What they do know is that there will be another pandemic, like the one that killed 20 to 40 million people in 1918. The big question is, are we prepared? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a second look at execution by lethal injection. First, here's the news.
Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. The so-called Spanish flu killed 20 to 40 million people in 1918. Medical historians say there will be another pandemic. On To The Point, it just might be caused by bird flu, or just as likely, it might not. In either case, will bird flu awaken the world to the inevitable and the need to prepare? On Reporter's Notebook, California has postponed an execution due to questions about lethal injection. Can the death penalty be administered humanely? First, this news update. Gunmen dressed in uniforms blew away the golden dome of a shrine that is sacred to Shiites today in Samarra, a town dominated by Sunnis. Crowds of Shiites took to the streets across the country. Sunni mosques have been attacked in retaliation. U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad calls it a deliberate effort to foment sectarian hostilities. Babak Deganpache is in Baghdad for Newsweek magazine. What is the situation like now in Baghdad?
Well, I think the situation is very tense. There has been, since mid-afternoon, a very heavy security presence in the streets of Baghdad in order to try and prevent any sectarian attacks. Although, as you mentioned, there have been a number of attacks carried out in Baghdad and other areas of the country against Sunnis and Sunni mosques.
This was a very brazen act at the Golden Mosque, apparently, handcuffing the guards, placing explosives around to make sure they were in the right place. Obviously, these people knew what they were doing. It was well planned in advance.
Definitely, a very brazen act, and I think trying to, send a very pointed message and trying to push the country closer to civil war. It is one of the holiest shrines to Shiites worldwide, and particularly to Iraqis. It is a very sacred place.
What has been the reaction to Ambassador Khalilzad to calling it, what you just said, a deliberate effort to foment sectarian hostilities?
Well, there hasn't been a whole lot of reaction from ordinary Iraqis, but some Iraqi politicians have spoken out and criticized Mr. Khalilzad a bit for pointing fingers in the sectarian blame game. In particular, Abdulaziz Hakim, one of the top Shiite politicians, spoke out and said that the U.S. was partly to blame for the increase in sectarian hostilities in recent days.
How is it that the U.S. is said to be to blame?
Well, I think a lot of people just see the conspiratorial hand of the U.S. Behind a lot of attacks, whether true or not. And I think it's just really the U.S. being here as an occupying power does get blamed for a lot of problems.
Talking with Babak Deganpache in Baghdad for Newsweek magazine. Well, what about the continuing effort to put together a government that isn't dominated by one sect or another?
Well, this is one of the big problems right now, as negotiations over the government are bogged down and more or less tied down along sectarian lines. Shiites and Kurdish parties and Sunni parties are all pushing for their say and having their appropriate share of the government. So I think that also adds to this problem where there is no strong government in place, a national unity government where all of these groups feel equally represented. And, in this situation, this kind of an attack can really increase the tensions a lot.
Back to the attack itself. How important is the mosque that apparently has been destroyed?
It's very important. It is one of the holiest shrines for Shiites worldwide. I think in Iraq, after Najaf and Karbala, the holy shrines there, you say that it's probably the third most important shrine in the country. It's a pilgrimage site. Pilgrims from Iran, from Pakistan, India, and elsewhere, Shiites do come to this mosque very frequently. And it's a site where the 12th Imam of the Shiite faith, the Imam Mahdi, is said to have disappeared.
But Samarra, the town where the mosque is located, is said to be dominated by Sunnis. So has it been a place where there's been a lot of violence and a lot of trouble?
That's correct, yes. I suppose it is odd in that respect that, that there is a very important Shiite shrine, but it's a predominantly Sunni town. So there hasn't been a lot of sectarian violence in Samarra itself, but Samarra has been a hotbed for the insurgency since the invasion of the U.S. There has been a lot of attacks between, a lot of conflict between the American troops and some of the insurgents in that town.
Well, what do you expect in the immediate future? Do you think that tomorrow there will be the same kind of heavy security, especially in Baghdad, that there has been today?
Definitely. This is what the Iraqi leaders have already spoken about, that they're going to, to send the police and possibly the army into the streets in Baghdad to try and prevent any further attacks. I think it's almost going to be a situation like martial law, where a lot of roads will be closed down and traffic will be restricted in certain areas, specifically with the goal of preventing sectarian attacks and then letting the situation spiral out of control.
Does that mean that American troops will be very much involved in trying to keep order in Baghdad?
That's tough to say. More than likely, American troops would let the Iraqi security forces take the lead on this one in order to keep themselves out of, to not get blamed for any attacks or any other trouble that may ensue.
In any case, I take it you were looking for tension, not that you haven't already had plenty of it, but increased tension, I gather, then in the days to come.
Definitely, definitely. I think really the key day to watch will be on Friday, which is the holy day of prayer in the Muslim world. I think some of these gatherings for both Sunnis and Shiites could be problematic, and I think the Iraqi government is going to try to do their best to secure these sites and prevent any attacks.
Well, thanks as always to you for being with us. Babak Daganpache, once again, Baghdad correspondent for Newsweek magazine. In a moment, bird flu and the next pandemic on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, only back with To the Point. Only 170 humans have been sickened by bird flu. Just 92 have died. But the spread of the virus in birds from Asia to Africa and now to Europe has led to fears that it could mutate so it could pass from human to human. That could lead to what's called a pandemic, an epidemic of worldwide proportions. Dick Thompson is chief of pandemic communication at the World Health Organization in Geneva. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I've seen it reported that a pandemic of some kind or other, like the one that occurred in 1918 and killed 20 to 40 million people, is inevitable. What are is it possible to predict that this might be it?
No, it's not. And it's not possible to predict whether or not it'll be as severe as 1918. There were two other pandemics in the 20th century, in 1957 and another in 1968, that many people hardly noticed. So a pandemic can be very mild, or it can be the most extreme contagious disease event in history, which 1918 was. But until the virus actually appears, the pandemic virus actually appears, we're not going to know what the case fatality rate is or what the target population is, what drugs might work against it. So there's a lot of unknowns about this.
Is there a possibility that it might just disappear?
That's right. This one could. We believe that the tools we have now are allowing us to watch a kind of gestational period, the evolution, the precursor of a pandemic. But we've never been in this position before. So it could be that what we're watching is something that occurs frequently, that is, embers that sort of flare up but never turn into a real pandemic.
What do you mean when you say we've never been in this position before?
We've never had such a global surveillance system, the tools of molecular biology to take apart a different virus, sentinels, hospital sentinel sites, such close surveillance of animals. And all of these have given us signals to identify this virus, the H5N1 avian flu virus, and to monitor its progression.
How soon might we know whether or not this is going to mutate in the way that might lead it to become so extremely dangerous and damaging?
Yeah, it's impossible to predict. Some people have said that this virus is just a couple steps away from becoming a pandemic virus. The Minister of Health in Indonesia said that because there appear to be cluster of cases there, human cases, that this virus is on the verge of going pandemic. But we simply don't know enough about pandemic viruses to say that with certainty. All we can do is monitor its evolution and prepare for an eventual pandemic, because there will be a pandemic. We don't know if it'll come from this virus or not, and we can't predict how severe the next pandemic will be. But we do know that with proper preparations, we can mitigate some of the damage which has always been associated with pandemics.
How are we doing in that regard?
Well, there's no country that's fully prepared to confront a human pandemic at the moment. There are some countries that are better prepared, and many, many countries which have really made no preparations at all. So we're not in a very good position at the moment.
In the meantime, how important is it for the animal spread, the spread in the birds, to be monitored and perhaps even contained?
It's incredibly important for lots of reasons, and not just because of the pandemic itself, but the disease is spreading into areas and killing a large number of poultry in many places, and you see poultry industries in places like Nigeria and in India. They're being just hammered because people are avoiding chicken, thinking that simply by eating chicken they're going to become sick, and that's not the case. So there's the damage that's done to an entire industry in countries where people are just struggling. Also, these large culls are taking away a large percentage of protein that these populations need, and food security is something we need to pay attention to. And lastly, there's the direct threat from the virus infecting a bird and then infecting a human, but that happens very, very rarely.
And when you say culls, you mean those are the birds that are being killed in order to try to prevent the spread.
That's right. It's a standard measure that's been used throughout Asia, being adopted in other places to stamp out this virus. But what we've seen is that in some places recently, the cull birds themselves are buried in large pits. We've seen people, we assume they're hungry, crawling into these pits and taking out the birds and using them for food. And this is a very dangerous practice. We're unclear, we're uncertain about how people become infected through diseased birds, but very likely it's through the defeathering process, because sick birds excrete a large amount of virus that goes into the soil and flies back up as dust, and defeathering a bird inhales a quantity of dust, and that may be how these people are getting infected.
Well, Dick Thompson, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Again, Chief of Pandemic Communication at the World Health Organization in Geneva. Dr. Joseph Domenech is Chief Veterinary Officer of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. He joins us from Rome. And Dr. Domenech, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Good evening.
Why is it that the virus is spreading so fast in birds?
Because it's a very highly contagious disease. It's, as a matter of fact, it's the most contagious disease you can find in poultry, almost as contagious that foot and mouth disease can be for ruminants, for cattle.
There have been reports and rumors from all over the world. What are the areas now, the countries of greatest concern?
Oh, well, the greatest concern today is still in some countries in Asia, such as Indonesia, Middle East and Eastern Europe, and most importantly now in Africa.
Why is Africa most important?
Because it's more difficult to tackle the disease in Africa because the veterinary services in general, the administration and the surveillance systems are not as efficient as they should be because they are understaffed and under-budgeted, and they are in a very difficult situation to control the disease.
What's the likelihood that the disease in birds will come to the United States?
Well, this depends on the capacity to stop the spread of virus in animals first, because this is the main source of the virus for humans, but also for other animals, including wild birds. The second thing is the capacity to understand exactly what is the role of the wild migratory birds and what are the species which are involved, and then to predict, because we know the migration's routes, to predict if it's going to come to other regions or not. For example, today in Africa, you find the virus. So wildlife could be infected if they are not already infected and the origin of the introduction in Africa. Nobody knows today for Nigeria. But evidently, some of these species coming from Asia and going to Western Africa will mix with other birds coming from Europe, Western and Northern Europe. So next spring, in a couple of, in 1 month, less than 2 months, they will come back, and then you can manage to have further spread, including in the Americas.
How many birds so far have been culled, to use the term we heard a moment ago, and how much has that damaged the poultry industry around the world?
Well, it's an economical disaster for the people, for the sector, for the producing sector, but also for the livelihoods of smallholders. The magnitude of cullings in Asia and now starting in Africa has been around, between 150 and 200 million of poultry and ducks
In 2 years. Are the countries that are most affected and that you're most worried about doing their best to cooperate? Do they have the resources to help to contain the disease?
The alert is maximum. The awareness and the commitment of the countries is maximum. This is not the problem. The problem is the capacity to respond, and among them are the human resources sometimes, but most importantly, the financial resources.
And are they being helped by other countries? Is there an organized effort to try to deal with this?
Yes, definitely, but it needs some time. You have seen in the international conference in Beijing 2 months ago that the pledges were more than what was estimated to be the needs. Almost $2 billion were pledged by the donors. And I was in Nigeria last week. I can tell you that all donors present in Nigeria were saying that they are ready to support the fight against the disease. So it's a matter of time, because it's difficult to implement massive campaigns with things such as closing completely the markets, stopping all movements of animals, culling all sick animals, and most probably starting targeted vaccination, I think.
I was going to ask about vaccination. We heard a moment ago that it's too early to try to develop a vaccination in the event that the virus mutates and passes from human to human, because nobody knows what it's going to look like. But is it possible now to have vaccines for animals?
I was talking about vaccination in animals, strictly speaking. So in animals, vaccine is already available. It's easy to get vaccine from at least 20 different producing laboratories. So there is no problem of vaccine at the animal side.
And is there a sufficient amount of it available?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Joseph Domenech, again, Chief Veterinary Officer of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. He joined us from Rome. Laurie Garrett is Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's a journalist and author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. Laurie Garrett, always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
What about this? The title of your book, of course, immediately comes to mind, and the notion that a pandemic is inevitable. We've heard that it's too early to tell if this is one. What should we do?
Well, there have been a lot of efforts made that are positive improvements in the state of preparedness and concern in the world. Dr. Domenech was mentioning the nearly $2 billion committed. That's not all dollars, actually. Some of it's in-kind services, some of it's loans that have to be paid back. But it still represents a phenomenal level of global commitment. The problem is that we're still racing to catch up with the virus. We're still not ahead of it. We're not in a state of preparedness or anticipation that puts us in a reasonable safety margin with this virus. And I find that really disturbing because a lot of aspects of what's happening with this H5N1 flu, the so-called bird flu right now, is following very predictive course. It's not mysterious. It's not a truly bizarre set of occurrences. We can, I think, with relative accuracy, predict where it's going to turn up next. Dr. Domenech was starting to say some of that regarding the upcoming spring migrations of birds, but I think we can even fairly reasonably predict when it's going to show up in the United States of America.
When's it going to happen?
Well, what we can see is that up until May of 2005, for about a decade, the virus was circulating mostly inside China and along the so-called East Asian Flyway, which extends from southern Indonesia all the way up into Siberia. And it wasn't until May that suddenly an explosive change occurred. That was when the virus made its way to a place called Lake Qinghai in central China that is a massive breeding site for dozens and dozens of different species of migratory birds. And it's species that not only do that classic Asian flyway, but do a couple of overlapping flyways migrating more towards Africa and towards Europe. At that time, peasants and farmers around the lake were reporting that they were finding dead birds all over the place. But the Chinese government still does not really have a reactive capacity that connects wildlife and veterinary medicine with public health, and frankly, almost nobody in the world does, including us. So they were slow to respond, didn't get in there fast enough to really figure out what was going on. And by then, we had a huge bird die-off, and the surviving birds were carrying the virus, and they headed up into Siberia. And by June, we were getting word of dead birds all over Siberia, and again, a broad species range that went from domestic chickens all the way up to extraordinary wild storks and swans and so on. And from there, you got cross-mixing into the flyways that take you right to the Black Sea. And not surprising at all, by the end of the summer, we had outbreaks in Azerbaijan, Armenia, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey, Greece, Cyprus, and eventually down into Iraq, where we have a truly out-of-control situation, as far as we can tell, involving not only birds but also human beings, into Saudi Arabia, across into Egypt. Clearly must have landed at Lake Chad because otherwise it's a lot of desert for birds to get over before hitting Nigeria.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to pause at that point because we need to take a break. Keep in mind that what we're hearing is the path of the bird flu, and the question I asked at the outset was, how soon might it arrive in the United States? We'll find that out from Laura Garrett. Continue this conversation with her and others. On Reporter's Notebook, California has postponed an execution. Is death by lethal injection inhumane? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Allen back again, talking today about bird flu. Not yet has it mutated in such a way that it can be transmitted from human to human, but it is very contagious amongst birds. There is a concern that it may be the next pandemic. We're talking now with Laura Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. So, Laura, you took us from Asia into Africa and now into Europe as well. The question being, when can we expect it in the United States?
So what we can see right now is that at least three major bird migratory flyways are contaminated with H5N1. One spans basically from northern Australia all the way up Asia into central Siberia. Another spans from Siberia across to the Black Sea and down into North Africa, taking in a fair swath of southern Europe along the way. And another one clearly goes right down the middle between the two of them, extending from Sri Lanka up through India, taking in Pakistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, etc. What is going to happen in the next 2 months as the Northern Hemisphere warms and the birds begin migrating further north is that we're going to see another cycle of it going through Siberia and another cycle of it going through Northern Europe. And what that will mean is, for the first time, we'll probably see it reach North America. It can come by one of two routes. Either it'll come across Siberia, over the Bering Straits, into Alaska. And if I were going to put my money on it, and I were going to tell Congress where to put a lot of money into bird surveillance, beefing up our capacity to see something happening there, I would say put a lot of money into Alaska right now. And I would activate bird watchers all over Alaska, amateur bird watchers. I would tell them what species to watch for, what kinds of bird deaths to be on the alert for. And I would certainly be recommending that, fortunately, there's not a big chicken industry in Alaska, but for those people who do keep birds in Alaska as either pets or livestock, to keep them indoors this spring and early summer. So the Alaska route immediately connects to every single bird flyway that goes up and down north-south of the Americas all the way down to southern Chile. The other route of entry that could very well be happening either at the same time or even before the Alaska one is contamination on what's called the East Atlantic Flyway, which extends up along the east coast of Africa all the way up to the United Kingdom, Iceland, Greenland, and then entry via northern Canada. And that would slam it right down the eastern seaboard of the United States to Brazil, the Falkland Islands, and southern Argentina.
So are they should Congress then be doing the same things in that area on the eastern seaboard as you propose that they do in Alaska?
Definitely. The Canadian government and the United States government should really be working in coordination here on trying to set up some very serious surveillance networks. And I find it really shameful that we haven't tried to activate these very, very avid, dedicated bird-watching amateurs all over the world. Indeed, right now in Africa, we could very well have far more extensive H5N1 contamination of bird populations in Africa than we know about, because there's very little in the way of a surveillance network of either human health or animal health in Africa. But if we had been activating bird-watching safari organizations, everything from your Abercrombie to your Audubon's, so that they knew how to report observations appropriately, where to report them to, and what species they should be looking for, we might be in better shape.
Laura Garrett, once again at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. We'll come back to her in a moment. First, here's Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and professor at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health, former advisor to the Health, Secretary of Health and Human Services from 2001 to 2004. Dr. Osterholm, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So it's inevitable then that the birds are coming and relatively soon to North America. How concerned should we be?
Well, I think the bottom line message, it's about the birds, but it's not about the birds. I mean, the situation today, what we really need to be thinking about is the ultimate concern is the human pandemic. And a human pandemic will only occur if this virus or any of the flu viruses either go through a what we call reassortment of mixing of one virus with another to create one that's capable of being transmitted via humans, or in fact, the virus itself mutates to the point where it now becomes a readily transmitted human-to-human agent. So on one hand, the birds moving around the world are important from a poultry industry standpoint, but if one looks at the number of domestic poultry and the actual virus concentration, Asia is still where the genetic roulette table is at. And so that from the standpoint of human health overall, this is not going to be, I believe, a big issue until the virus mutates or reassorts, which I believe mutation is probably the greater likelihood. And I still believe that's going to be primarily an Asian concern.
So does that mean then that we don't have to worry about it in the United States?
Well, I wouldn't say don't worry about it. For example, when it finally does arrive here, as we're seeing in Europe, there will be a sense of panic around that issue. And if you're in the poultry industry, obviously it's great concern. We have a very different poultry industry in the United States, and for that matter, much of America, of the Americas in total, where they are already housed inside of biosecurity barns, meaning that they're not in the open where they're going to come in contact with wild birds. So the impact here should be substantially less than we see in other parts of the world where that's not the case. The other part of that, of course, is that in terms of the impact on industry around the world, Dick Thompson said it very well, those of us in public health worry not just about dying from disease, but dying from lack of food. And clearly, poultry have been a very important part of the protein diet around the world. And so we have a concurrent concern about just can we feed the 6.5 billion people on the face of the earth if we have this terrible ongoing pandemic in birds, which it really is now a pandemic in birds.
What are the prospects, do you think, of it becoming a pandemic in human beings?
Well, actually, I take a position on the H5N1 that is one that's just based on the data. This virus is a kissing cousin to the 1918 H1N1 virus that caused that pandemic. So to talk about the parallels, it's not just because it was a bad situation, but the genetic studies we've done to date have shown clearly mutations occurring in this virus that are very similar to what we're seeing in the 1918 virus. A study released just several weeks ago actually looking at many thousands of viral genomes from influenza viruses dating back to the earliest isolates, as well as complete virus genomes, show that the only two viruses that had a very unique protein tag, part of the non-structural gene part of the virus, which has a lot to do with why it causes such severe illness, were the 1918 H1N1 and the H5N1. In addition to that, we've actually seen a very different clinical illness. H5N1 kills the same way the 1918 virus kills, not just from secondary pneumonias, but actually initially from the impact of the virus causing what we call a cytokine storm. Those parallels are so striking. In addition, we know the 1918 virus jumped directly from birds to humans. It didn't go through this reassortment or mixing of viruses in another species like pigs or even humans. So there are so many parallels there that any scientist has to at least keep their eye on the ball. And I think Dick Thompson said it well earlier, pandemics are going to happen again. They're like earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis. Whether it's going to be H5N1, we don't know. But today, a pandemic, even a mild one with this world's population, will still be many millions of deaths. And I think that that's an important consideration that people haven't often thought about.
Dr. Michael Osterholm at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Mark Siegel is an internist and associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine. He's author of Bird Flu, Everything You Need to Know About the Next Pandemic. Dr. Siegel, welcome to you.
Hello, Warren.
How do you feel about what we just heard from Dr. Osterholm, who painted a fairly grim picture?
Well, I would add a few things to it. First of all, I think he's factually 100% correct, although one thing he didn't emphasize is that the similarities between the 1918 virus and this virus don't automatically, of course, predict that it's going to take that major mutation in the direction that will cause it to cross the species barrier and become easily passed human to human. That's the worst-case scenario. The similarity is the way it kills, and it's obvious at this point that it's a massive killer among birds. It was obvious before it spread to this degree. So I think the biggest mandate is to take the bird spread very seriously and develop a better way to try to control this in the bird population with a lot more money, as was said at the outset of your program, a lot more interaction. I agree with what Laurie Garrett said. We also need a better way to survey birds, and we should start to use amateur surveillance because the migratory pathways, even if they're predictable, are very tricky in small birds. So we can do a better job at trying to put out the fire, not just build the firewall to protect the human population. And I would add, though, that it's important not to minimize the human pandemic risk, but not to automatically assume it'll be this virus. And one thing that Dr. Osterholm has repeatedly said, which I completely agree with, is we're completely unprepared for any pandemic. So that means we have to start off by improving the way we make vaccines in this country. We're using over 50-year-old technology still, which is inexcusable. We need more government involvement in terms of getting that to happen because the vaccine manufacturers have really fled the flu industry. They don't want to make influenza shots. We don't have hospitals prepared for any pandemic situation. We're reliant on substances from other countries, food, medications, all from other countries, we would probably be shut off if a panic occurred. And if a pandemic occurs, a panic will occur. That makes fear a very important virus to consider here. A lot of people say to me, oh, fear isn't a problem. But when you see 70% of Italy no longer eating poultry because of one outbreak, you have to consider fear and how fear will occur when birds get this virus in the United States. And I agree with all the people, all your guests, that it will come to the United States. But we're woefully underprepared to deal with the fear that will occur.
Dr. Osterholm, back to you. What about the prospect of getting more interest on the part of the pharmaceutical companies to develop vaccines and to do it here in this country?
Well, first of all, let me just make it really clear that the preparedness we're talking about here is preparedness that is really industry defining, meaning we're talking about decades of preparation that would take. Right now, for us to get a new influenza vaccine, which would basically jump over that 50-year-old technology, by itself, if we did a Manhattan-like project initiative starting today, would be at least 5 to 8 years down the road before we could really come up with that technology, get it approved through the normal process. Then in addition, one of the things that I find very curious is that how American-centric we've become in this situation. We believe if we protect ourselves, we're covered, meaning enough vaccine for 300 million people. And in fact, when a pandemic occurs, the global economy is going to crash. We will close borders, just as we saw South Korea last night recommend people not travel to Egypt, of which over 70,000 South Koreans travel annually to Egypt, over just basically several flocks that are H5N1 infected. When that happens, many of the products and services that you and I count on every day, 80% of all the drugs in the United States that we use for all reasons, the raw ingredients come from offshore. I can go through a laundry list of most of the medical products, many of the other essential services and products. So it is really in our, not only our best interest, but frankly, it is imperative that we look at how do we protect the world. Well, to think about having enough vaccine of the type that we could use against a future pandemic strain and produce it in the manner in which it should be produced in volume, that is at least a decade off if we start a Manhattan Project tonight. So many of us are trying to do simultaneous preparedness, that which is what happens if it happens tonight, what happens if it's a year from now, and what if it is 10 years from now? Mm-hmm. What are all the things that we can do simultaneous to that? And the vaccine is a way, way down the road okay. to kind of answer.
Dr. Siegel, back to you. Are we working closely enough with other countries around the world and taking this worldwide approach?
Well, I think in birds, we're starting to pick that up. I think, you know, as your guest at the beginning of the program brought up, that's becoming more and more of an issue. You know, certainly the USDA has been very involved or is becoming more involved in worldwide surveillance and in sending people over. I think that has to be increased greatly. In terms of Dr. Osterholm's point about vaccines, you know, he's right that we're several years away, but, you know, Warren, you should also know that we use this technology regularly in hepatitis vaccines and in chickenpox vaccines. So the kind of technology that he and I both agree should be useful, it's really a shame that it's that far away, and it has to do with private interest. And, you know, certainly the vaccine manufacturers were scared off in the 1970s when the swine flu fiasco occurred, even though they didn't get directly liable, and they're not directly liable now. It's a public relations nightmare if something goes wrong with a vaccine. So that's one of the reasons I think we need more government involvement. But in terms of preparing for the worst-case scenario, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about H5N1 mutating over the next year or two, I think that all has to be considered. And I think we all agree that the worst-case scenario with H5N1 is very bad, although, again, there are a lot of unpredictable factors. We can't just take the historical precedent of 1918 and just superimpose that on this situation. We have to learn from it, but it's not exactly an identical situation. Many things right now would make it worse for us than 1918, and many things would make it better for us.
Okay, let me go back to Laura Garrett. You wrote The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance, several years ago. I guess the next question would be this. If it's not H5N1, it's going to be something else that has been predicted by everybody on this program and seems to be represent the consensus of authorities. What do we need to do that would make us prepared for any pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I've, I've, I'm I'm very much enjoying the conversation here because I have so much respect for all the participants and for what they've been saying. And Mike Osterholm in particular has been a loud voice on the horizons of this for a very long time, and I'm happy to know that he's now at least getting listened to. And, you know, this is the thing. I wrote The Coming Plague more than 10 years ago, and some scientists have been predicting that we would be in this kind of situation for a very long time, and they've not been listened to. I think, really, where we're at, Warren, is a fundamental challenge to the concept of globalization. If there is anything that represents globalized threat, it is the spread of microbes. You know, we've been very fixated on the globalized threat, supposedly, of terrorism, but even in the wildest fantasies of what a terrorist might be able to have as a weapon of mass destruction, you don't come close to what a pandemic virulent influenza could do and what it could disrupt, how many lives it could take, and so on. So the fundamental challenge of this early historical period of the 21st century, as we witness a process every bit as dramatic as the Industrial Revolution or even as the dawn of organized agriculture, this thing we call globalization, is whether or not we can not only globalize economics and globalize culture and globalize human movement and so on, but also globalize preparedness, globalize health safety, globalize risk assessment. And that means going way beyond our current antiquated 20th century nation-state models of how we prepare for global health emergencies into something that's really about networks of nations, regional responses, and entire international responses that recognize that 75% of all wealth in the world is concentrated in only 9 countries. And if those 9 countries are not willing to pay a very hefty percentage of the tab and provide a very hefty percentage of the expertise to make a global health safety network work, function properly, there will be no safety, not only for the poor of the world, but also for the rich of the world.
Laurie Garrett, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks to Dr. Mark Siegel and Dr. Michael Osterholm as well, and our earlier guests, Dick Thompson and Joseph Demenich as well. We'll come back to this subject, of course, on later programs. Last night, for the second time, California delayed the execution of Michael Morales, who's admitted to the torture, rape, and murder of a 17-year-old girl. But a federal judge has raised questions about lethal injection. Is it cruel and unusual punishment banned by the 8th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. As conducted by 37 of 38 states, the practice of lethal injection involves the use of 3 drugs. The first puts a convict to sleep. The second stops voluntary muscle control. The third stops the heart, and it can be very painful. If the first drug does not do its job, loss of muscle control from the second drug would prevent the convict from indicating that he or she was still awake. The Morales execution in California has been postponed because federal judge Jeremy Fogel wants medical evidence of whether that raises constitutional issues. Deborah Dinow is professor of law at Fordham University in New York. Professor, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
What about this issue, then, that it might be cruel and unusual punishment if, in fact, the convict can feel the pain from that third drug? How serious an issue is that?
Well, I think the courts have already shown that it's a very serious issue. The more medical evidence we have about these drugs, the more likely it is to indicate that there is pain involved.
Is that also true based on the observation of people that have, in fact, been executed by lethal injection?
Well, there has been evidence that that some of these people have, in fact, been in pain based on autopsies after the fact and also observations.
And how do autopsies show that?
The autopsies indicate that that the first drug, the sodium thiopental, doesn't seem to have been in the body long enough to have made the inmate asleep before the second drug is administered.
So what would it mean for a lethal injection, then, as practiced in 37 of 38 states, if it's determined that it may, in fact, lead to cruel and unusual punishment?
Well, I think there's a possibility that this issue might create a mini moratorium in this country on the death penalty, because there's no alternative method of execution presently.
What about the presence of medical people? That didn't happen in California because doctors, anesthesiologists that were going to take part decided that they would have to be too involved and that their ethics wouldn't prevent that. Would it help if medical people were available and could be more closely involved?
Well, there's really a contradiction here. On the one hand, it would help to have medical people involved, and experienced anesthesiologists in particular. On the other hand, the medical community has ethical problems about being involved. So it's a catch-22, and the courts are facing this dilemma presently.
First, do no harm, part of the Hippocratic Oath, very basic to what all doctors agree to do.
Well, that's right, and it doesn't mean that doctors are doing anything illegal by participating in an execution. There's no law that says they can't do that, but there's certainly a very strong norm and an expectation that they don't.
So when you say a mini moratorium, would that be in all these different states?
Well, it could be. We've already seen that this one judge, and a judge in a very respectable court, is thinking that there's a problem with this method. It would make sense that other judge would think accordingly.
Again, Judge Jeremy Fogel in California. Deborah Denno, again, is professor of law at Fordham University. Douglas Berman is professor of law at Ohio State University. And, Professor, glad to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Do you agree that this is likely to have immediate repercussions?
I think it's just another example of how hard it is for the state to kill. And ultimately what it's going to force is just yet another round of conversation about how committed we are to having the death penalty. I think to the extent that the politics remain such that a majority of Americans favor having the death penalty, ultimately we'll work through this issue and get a greater contentment with the process for executing.
How do you think that's going to happen if you can't get medical people to be closely enough involved to determine what's really going on?
That's a very good question, and my guess would be at some point there will be some medical people who will be willing to get involved, or at the very least, if a state's willing to pay enough in a variety of ways to get help with this process, it's likely a method will be found.
In the meantime, do you think then that we will see states all over the country waiting for some sort of determination of that kind?
We're sort of seeing that, although it's been a state-by-state process. Really what touched all this off was the Supreme Court agreeing to hear a case on a procedural issue relating to lethal injection coming out of Florida back in late January. And each state that's had an execution planned since then has been struggling to figure out what to do. Texas, somewhat not surprisingly, has been able to go ahead with a number of executions since then, but California obviously had this episode that slowed the process down and created a mini moratorium, I think, in California. The same has been true in Florida. There's a case out of Missouri that also has been held up. But again, there have been other executions that have gone forward, and it really will be a state-by-state determination of how committed they are to trying to get an execution to go forward while there's this uncertainty.
The United States Supreme Court, as I understand it, has never found any method of execution to be unconstitutional. Are there other courts that have, particularly Supreme Courts of any of the states?
I believe there was a case involving a hanging where an inmate was too heavy to successfully be hung. And so there have been explorations of these issues. Again, the interesting thing is many state Supreme Courts have looked extraordinarily closely at lethal injection protocols, and typically they have affirmed their constitutionality from the state perspective. And so this has been an issue that's been percolating for quite some time, and I really think it is time for the Supreme Court to weigh in and create some clarity here. I'm fearful they won't do that anytime soon, though.
Professor Douglas Berman at Ohio State. Back to Professor Denno at Fordham. Do you think the U.S. Supreme Court is likely anytime soon to resolve this in a way that could be satisfactory around the country?
Well, that's a hard question to say whether it could be satisfactory around the country. I think they're going to come to some sort of resolution that's going to ensure temporarily that the death penalty will continue to be followed in this country, but I think it's going to take a long time for any sort of resolution that's going to be successful.
Are some states, Professor Berman mentioned Texas, which has had a lot of executions in recent years, more likely to just go forward with executions than others?
Well, I think Texas and other kinds of states are likely to go forward. I mean, we've always had states that have been more gung-ho with the death penalty than others, and it seems likely that they would do so.
Professor Berman, there are something like 3,000 death row inmates around the country. All of them have lawyers, many of them more than one. Do you suppose that as we speak, there are roughly that many lawyers preparing appeals based on this case?
Well, the interesting and somewhat disconcerting reality of this kind of challenge is it only really becomes ripe within the short time frame when an execution is set up. So the vast majority of those 3,000 persons on death row are pursuing other kinds of appeals and are unlikely to be executed anytime soon. It's only those individuals on death row who are nearing the end of their appeal process that are really even in a position to make a challenge about these issues. And one thing that's been fought in the courts is what's the right time to raise one of these sorts of challenges. And so I certainly think we can predict there will be lots and lots of litigation, although probably it'll be, you know, 5 or 10 leading the way rather than all 3,000.
All right. Well, we will, of course, be watching this, as will people all over the country. And I want to thank you both for being with us today. Douglas Berman, professor of law, Ohio State University, and Deborah Deno, professor of law at Fordham University in New York. Thanks again to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Sherman Rimbaum with Christian Bordahl and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.